This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Kathy Dre of the American Lung Association says 10 years after the indoor smoking ban, 90% of Illinois residents think it's a good idea.
I think that that says it all right there. You can't even get 9 out of 10 people to agree that the sky is blue.
Eric Stock reports on the lingering effects of the ban on both health and business. Plus, McLean County is on a poverty watch list from the Heartland Alliance. Mary Cullen has that report. And Colleen Reynolds looks at teen vaping in the Twin Cities. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It has been 10 years since Illinois went smoke-free in all public buildings, including bars and restaurants. GLT's Eric Stock looks back at the arguments that were made for and against the indoor smoking ban to see if new data and the passage of time have changed anyone's perspective on what was a hotly debated issue.
Bloomington Normal actually went smoke-free a year before the rest of the state. McLean County also passed its own smoking ban, but it exempted home-based businesses and 6 liquor establishments in unincorporated areas of the county. Those exemptions were later wiped out by the statewide ban. Talk of a ban sparked heated debate before its inception, particularly in bars and restaurants. Many establishment owners feared it would put a dent in their business at a time when profit margins are already thin.
You know, I saw a 15 to 20% decrease in business, and it's never gotten any better.
Tyler Holloway owns Fat Jack's Bar in downtown Bloomington and Maggie Miley's restaurant in Uptown Normal. He says it was especially tough on the bar because he sold cigars at Fat Jack's. That was about a $50,000 a year hit in sales.
I've tried to replace my cigar sales because we did quite a large amount of cigar sales, for that product out of here up until then, and then it went to zero, basically.
Holloway says many who liked to light up at his bar simply stopped coming.
There was a certain percentage of people that stopped coming out as much, put it that way. And, I know one couple that actually built a bar in their basement and just invited their smoking friends over to their house every Friday happy hour instead of coming here.
In other cases, Holloway says customers who are smoking outside are less likely buying alcohol. That also eats into sales. Fat Jack started serving food after the smoking ban was enacted, and many other bars recouped some of their lost revenue after the state legalized video gaming, though Holloway says adding video gambling machines hasn't completely erased that shortfall. Jen Lancaster owns The Bistro, a downtown Bloomington bar, and had co-owned Lancaster's, a fine dining restaurant, which closed in 2014.
We were told in endless meetings with different parties that the non-smoking community that was always complaining about, how it was so smoky in the bars, that they would come out and now support our businesses once the ban was in effect, and that did not happen.
Lancaster's biggest objection, she says bar and restaurant owners had no say in the matter. She says several had proposed a licensing fee they'd be willing to pay to have a smoking section in their establishments. That idea, she said, fell on deaf ears.
We're small independent bar owners, business owners, and I really thought that it should have been a decision that each of us made on our own.
While many business owners saw the indoor smoking ban as a government intrusion, health advocates praised the ban then and praise the ban now.
Our children are growing up expecting smoke-free indoor areas.
Kathy Dre, Vice President of Advocacy for the American Lung Association of Illinois, was one of the main advocates for the statewide ban when it passed in 2007. She says the health of smokers and non-smokers alike should trump the wishes of any business owner.
Restaurants and bars close all the time for many reasons. The people of Illinois have adjusted. They've come to expect indoor facilities to be smoke-free.
The American Lung Association polled Illinois residents before the smoking ban went into effect and on the 10-year anniversary of the ban. A decade ago, Illinoisans were evenly split on the issue. A decade later, nearly 9 in 10 polled said they support the ban.
I think that it says it all right there. You can't even get 9 out of 10 people to agree that the sky is blue, you know, let alone support for a law like this.
The survey shows only 3 in 10 who smoke themselves oppose the ban. The Illinois Department of Public Health reports in the 10 years since the smoking ban passed, hospitalizations for asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and heart attacks, all conditions aggravated by secondhand smoke, have fallen 20%. In McLean County, smoking rates have dropped. Just prior to the ban, close to 21% of adults had smoked. The latest figures from 2013 showed it dropped to below 12%, nearly cut in half in 5 years. While there's no proof these bans or other restrictions have caused more people to kick the habit, Dre suggests it all plays a part.
You know, all these things work hand in hand. The increase in the tax on cigarettes and other tobacco products also works to decrease those smoking prevalence rates.
Bar owners Tyler Holloway and Jan Lancaster, both non-smokers themselves, say the issue goes beyond health. Lancaster says the indoor ban forces smokers outside onto sidewalks that are already crowded on weekends when college students are in town. She says a combination of overly congested walkways with pedestrians, many of whom have been drinking, has often become a recipe for trouble.
You would have two people go out and smoke, and then all of a sudden all their friends had to go out and stand with them too. And that created some problems on the street with late night problems as far as vandalism, you know, people making comments, etc.
And the bar owners say they don't have the time or the staffing to monitor foot traffic outside their businesses. This begs the question, who is enforcing the smoking ban? Police are typically on the front lines in the war on smoking, but Bloomington, Normal, and McLean County Sheriff's Police say they get few, if any, complaints. Sheriff John Sandage.
I think when the law was initially passed, we kind of took the stance that we weren't going to become the smoking police. However, if we do run across a violation, we will report it.
Sandage adds his officers aren't able to set aside time to specifically look for smoking scoff laws, but they do occasionally conduct sting operations looking for underage drinkers.
What we look for, of course, when we do not only bar checks, but our liquor inspections that we do through the Illinois Liquor Commission, we look for violations and have not found any.
Police believe the various public education campaigns about where you can and can't smoke have taken hold. Smoking ban enforcement responsibility actually lies with the McLean County Health Department through a federal grant provided by the Centers for Disease Control. Katie McHugh, Health Promotion Program Manager for the McLean County Health Department, says enforcement is typically based on complaints. Those can be filed on the health department's website. But she says the county sanitation crews will sometimes find suspected violators on their own.
We work with our environmental health, the sanitarians, to do that. So they're already going around doing routine inspections, and it's part of that checklist that they have to go through to check for ashtrays is usually the giveaway.
The county received just 8 smoking complaints in the last year. Fines start at $250, but McHugh says fines are rare.
They get a letter, and that usually takes care of it. People don't want to not be in compliance, but if need be, and I haven't had to deal with this yet, but if need be, we can go further on, and there are fines and citations that get written.
Second-time offenders are supposed to get fined $500, a third offense in the same year warrants a $2,500 fine. The county has levied 16 fines since the ban's inception in 2008, but none since 2015. Only 2 were ever fined the maximum $2,500. McHugh says the health department puts more of its attention on prevention. It offers no smoking and no e-cigarette window signs for businesses. Though McHugh supports the ban herself, says she notices the difference whenever she leaves Illinois.
It certainly is a shock to me when I go to Indianapolis to go to concerts, or I go to Missouri and people can smoke in restaurants or things like that. I'm always thankful that in Illinois that's not something that we have to deal with. And I think most other people probably feel the same way.
The indoor smoking ban doesn't include e-cigarettes, which health advocates consider to be far more addictive and are heavily marketed to younger smokers. McHugh suspects vaping will soon be regulated the same way.
The FDA is starting to regulate them and things like that. It's just not included yet. There's all kinds of policies are starting to add language. If it already included language about tobacco, they're starting to add language about e-cigarettes too.
Bloomington banned the use of e-cigarettes in all city-owned buildings in 2016, but vaping is otherwise okay in other public buildings. While bar owners like Tyler Holloway say they don't like how the smoking ban has hurt their business, they do see some benefit.
I actually enjoy the fact that I don't have someone sitting next to me smoking at the bar, and that I don't go home at night after work smelling like an ashtray. So that is nice.
I'm Eric Stock.
Illinois is now one of 25 states that has a public smoking ban.
Support for GLT comes from Vitesse Cycles Shop, where your patronage and friendship is valued. Vitesse Cycles' goal is to promote health and well-being through cycling. Learn more about the Electra Townie and other bike brands, all with Vitesse's professional advice, service, and accessories at VitesseCycle.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, McLean County's poverty rate is spiking. Mary Cullen has a report. Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin and 13 other colleagues are asking the Federal Food and Drug Administration to better regulate companies that sell vaping products and e-cigarettes clearly marketed at kids with names like cotton candy and cookies and cream. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds penetrates the haze obscuring vaping's growth as the most popular tobacco product among teens and young adults, thanks to $63 million in traditional and social media marketing last year by major e-cigarette companies.
Hey vapers, Abby here, and it's the video you've all been waiting for. How to blow smoke rings. Today we are vaping on Alpha Vapes, the dude, because I'm obsessed with it, and it is a pineapple peach, and it is awesome.
If you think videos like what you just heard and others like it on YouTube are not having an impact, consider Ian Hoganson, a 16-year-old Bloomington High School student.
It all just kind of started probably like freshman year. I'll be going into junior when those big vape mods were a cool thing and all the smoke tricks and whatnot. Kind of no nicotine, just kind of like with the O's and whatnot. Just kind of to mess around with, nothing really harmful.
Hoganson admits he was enamored by the wafting smoke rings on those videos, but because of his self-admitted addictive tendencies, he was also sucked in for another reason.
Now it's kind of just moved on to more of the nicotine buzz with like the Juuls and whatnot. I have kind of like sparked popularity in sophomore year. It's kind of just what I use these days.
Hoganson is not alone.
Teens are more likely, some of the research right now suggests that 4 times more likely to walk into a cigarette habit.
That's Liz Hamilton, community program coordinator for Bloomington-based Chestnut Health Systems, well-respected globally in the addiction treatment field. Hamilton says the Illinois Youth Survey from this spring, an anonymous survey of 8th, 10th, and 12th graders, showed 26% of Central Illinois high school seniors and 15% of sophomores are using e-cigarettes. That's double from just 2 years ago when the state first started tracking use. Vaporizing devices come in all shapes and sizes, from custom-built bong-like devices that can blow plumes of billowing vapor to the tiniest that look like a USB drive, with the top seller referred to as a Juul, by far the most popular popular among teens. According to Hamilton, Juuls can deliver up to 4 times as much nicotine as a traditional cigarette, so addiction occurs faster. And she says research shows teens have no idea what they're taking in.
I've seen some recent research that suggests that 63% of the Juul users are unaware that there is nicotine in their product.
In fact, that same recent youth survey showed only about 1/4 of high school students perceived vaping as harmful. Remember our 16-year-old BHS student, Ian Hoganson? He's become addicted to nicotine, but he says other kids don't seem to know or care what they're vaping.
It's crazy how all these trending devices like a Juul can actually get kids addicted to nicotine, and they don't even really notice it. They don't even really think it's a big deal. And I don't know if they know like the true definition of being an addict, but that's what a lot of these kids are becoming at my school.
Hoganson wishes he never started vaping, and he has a message for his 14-year-old brother Sam and other younger students.
You're not missing out on a lot in the way your brain's developing. I mean, I sound like a mom, but it's really not good to get into.
Hoganson not only sounds like his mother, he sounds like the head of the Federal Drug Administration, who recently pointed out nicotine in vaping products can rewire an adolescent's brain, leading to years of addiction. Chestnut Health Systems Hamilton says most addictions do have roots in the teen years, and she argues vaping is a gateway to other tobacco use.
Teens are more likely, some of the research right now suggests that 4 times more likely to walk into a cigarette habit.
23-year-old college student Kyle Fitzgerald already had a cigarette habit by age 15, growing up in suburban Chicago Heights. He found nicotine helped with stress and anxiety he felt in high school.
After about 3 months, you're kind of addicted to cigarettes and you like that buzz and that feeling in your head. So I was looking for something that I can do where I wouldn't get in trouble because my mom has the nose of a bloodhound.
At age 16, Kyle found his answer in the form of a vape pen that his stepfather began using to kick his addiction to chewing tobacco.
So I would go into his room and I'd take his little vape pen and I'd use it. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is awesome. I want my own, because he always knew when I'd use it. So I went out and I got a couple friends together, and I found one of my friends who was 18, and we went to Indiana where it's cheap and really accessible.
At age 17, Fitzgerald's mom found his Sherlock Holmes style vaporizing pipe and threw it out. He returned to cigarettes because he says he could no longer invest in vaping supplies.
I think it was like $45 for just one of the smaller, like 60 milliliter bottles. That would last me probably like 1.5 weeks. Yeah.
Now Fitzgerald is back to vaping because today's smaller devices are cheaper. Online, they go for as low as $10, including 1 cartridge of vape juice, and they're easier to get. Hoganson told us it's been easy to get supplies from what he describes as sketchy gas stations.
Just kind of crazy how a 13-year-old kid could walk into a gas station and get whatever they want. No IDs or whatnot.
Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner says his agency hasn't specifically tracked violations of sales of vaping products to anyone under 18, but he plans in the future to separate out tobacco and vaping-related violations due to what appears to be, in his words, a growing problem. To date, he's not aware of any vaping sale violations. Bloomington Police Public Information Officer Elias Mendiola says he didn't have access to information about tobacco or vaping sale violations readily available, but added he's not sure the metrics will, as he put it, show anything significant.
Yeah, it's been a problem of people doing it right out in the open.
That's Bloomington High School Assistant Principal Michael Shanley, who says because students are able to use such small devices, vaping violators are getting pretty bold about sneaking a hit.
So we've had a couple instances of students doing it in the classroom. Mostly it's been in bathrooms. It's been reported students doing it in their car in the parking lot. We have had instances of a kid doing it in the cafeteria.
One enterprising company has developed a smartphone app that connects to a system to detect vapor from e-cigs. Shanley says no such drastic measures at Bloomington High School yet, but with a population of 1,500 students, the school saw 14 violations for tobacco this school year, and all were vaping-related, compared to 2 disciplinary actions against students caught vaping last school year. Shanley admits administrators were caught off guard about how fast use is growing.
We're seeing it across all demographics. We're seeing it across all socioeconomic status. You know, it's a lot of, I'm seeing a lot of different types of kids who get caught for this. It's not just one group.
In Unify, Normal Community High School principal Trevor Chapman says there were 28 tobacco violations among more than 2,150 students this year, and all but two were vaping related. First offense results in an in-school suspension. Chapman will be working this summer on an anti-vaping campaign with Hamilton from Chestnut and the BN Parents Campus Community Committee. Chapman believes it could include embedding more information into health classes, but he thinks it should also include a student-to-student strategy.
I mean, students certainly react much more positively and sometimes, I would say, pay more attention when it's their peers that are providing information to them. And so we are hopeful that as students assist us in this, that the rest of our student population is more willing to listen.
Normal Community class of 2015 grad Benjamin Nielsen, now an Illinois Wesleyan University student, will be helping with that anti-vaping strategy. He's involved in a program called Always Unstoppable and visits local high schools championing individuality to give students confidence to make good choices. In high school, Nielsen didn't really have friends who vaped. Today, he knows many who do, and he says none are casual users.
I have roommates that are waking up, and the first thing they're doing before they go brush their teeth is they're sucking in nicotine from their device that's charging overnight, and it's literally one of the first things they're doing when they're waking up, and they're doing it periodically throughout the day.
Nielsen says a campaign to educate parents and teens will help, but he's convinced kids won't respond to messages about long-term health effects.
A lot of these teenagers are just thinking about the now. They've got to find a way to show short-term side effects or short-term disadvantages to vaping or the flavored nicotine.
Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says the tobacco industry has dusted off its old cigarette marketing plan to hook another generation, which will be addicted to a new nicotine product that can be vaped. McLean County Health Department Director Camille Rodriguez stood with Durbin during a recent local news conference. Before arriving here 7 months ago, Rodriguez worked for the Wisconsin Public Health Department, heading up tobacco prevention. She worked on a campaign for parents called Tobacco is Changing.
If it's got nicotine in it, it's addictive. Some people struggle their whole lives to quit. I don't want that for my kids. So what can a parent do? Start by learning more about the new tobacco products out there. Get involved and make sure your kids know sweet flavors don't make tobacco products any safer or less addictive. Tobacco's changing, parents. We've got to keep up.
For teenagers, Rodriguez says appealing to their vanity, in a way turning a mirror on bad visuals with vapors, might make an impact.
Teeth coloring and watery, itchy eyes can be all a part of the after effects. And we know how our young people love to be on Instagram and do selfies. And so if you even used that sort of take on the matter, you could definitely perhaps make some headway.
Amanda Hoganson, Ian's mom, thinks the school's zero tolerance policies are good. And she believes for the novice user, anti-vaping campaigns can help. For students like her son who are already addicted, her strategy has been to call him out on his use, encourage a better alternative such as exercise, and hope for the best.
They're still going to do it. And what I hope for mine is that it's just a phase and that it will end, but with little to no side effects health-wise.
Someone who says he's in better health today because of vaping won't debate the science, but shares his personal positive experience of switching from cigarettes to vaping. Chris Hyatt, a 30-year-old Normal Community West High School grad, started his Liquid Temptations vaping juice business 4 years ago at a time when he weighed nearly 300 pounds and felt like he was having a heart attack. He quit smoking, started vaping, and now Hyatt is a mixologist of sorts, creating vaping liquid for handheld mods and larger devices. Hyatt has perfected concoctions with names such as Crunch Cake and Uproar, described as a grape frozen sorbet taste. He supplies several of Bloomington Normal's 13 stores specifically selling tobacco and vaping products. He makes some juices without any nicotine and says he limits nicotine content to no more than 6 milligrams in a 60 milliliter bottle. For reference, one cigarette has between 8 and 20 milligrams. Like many advocates, Hyatt comes from the position of reducing harm, but he's not ready to definitely claim vaping is healthier than smoking. However, Hyatt says he feels better.
I quit smoking, like, oh my God, I was able to start eating better, start exercising. I run miles now where I couldn't run a half mile before. So it's definitely helped change my life for the better and a lot of other people I know.
Hyatt counts his own mother, a smoker for decades, as one of his success stories. However, federal regulators say there is not enough evidence using e-cigarettes are an effective way to stop smoking. And so far, no vaping or e-cigarette companies have applied for FDA approval for smoking cessation use. Still, Chris Hyatt says his home base of the Smoker's Den in downtown Bloomington sees a lot of elderly patients who were longtime smokers who have now started vaping. After a few months, he says, they come in unassisted instead of using walkers. But aren't they just transferring one addiction to another?
They will come in and they will get an e-cig set up and they will vape it. And once their nicotine's dropped from a higher level to a lower level, they're done with it altogether.
Hyatt understands the argument that vaping could be creating a new generation of addicts, but he insists his business doesn't market to kids and that his higher price point at $200 or more for a device acts as a deterrent. Still, Hyatt, who has two small children, would be okay with some additional regulation.
The label's not catering towards children. You know, we did our best to build a brand to where it's definitely more adult geared. We're okay with the warning label being on the bottle. We don't care that it takes up promotional space for our company.
Hyatt opposes raising the age for sale of vaping products to 21. He says that'll only drive younger customers to the black market and to neighboring states. 25 Illinois cities, including Peoria and Chicago, have already restricted sale of tobacco and vaping products to adults 21 and older. A bill to impose the age limit statewide is on Governor Rauner's desk. If he signs it, Illinois would join five other states that have already raised the age to 21. The governor's office says he's reviewing the legislation along with 600 other bills on his desk, and Rauner hasn't made any public statements on the subject. The Illinois Department of Revenue estimates the impact could reduce Illinois sale tax receipts by $41 to $48 million in the first year. Meanwhile, Dick Durbin continues to collect evidence, and he's urging the FDA not to wait to stop companies from hooking kids with flavored vaping juices and alluring marketing.
While the jury is out on this conversion from combustible tobacco to vaping as to whether that actually is a legitimate purpose for this product, the vigor and commitment of the industry in hooking our kids is unmatched.
In a letter to school superintendents in May, Durbin asks them to provide him with data about the extent of vaping in middle and high schools and solicited suggestions for what Congress should do legislatively to prevent kids from becoming addicted. Chestnut Health's Linda Hamilton says legislation restricting sales and marketing to kids is needed, but reaching children with the right message could really make an impact.
Some sort of a message that shows a Juul and some of the other vaping devices that says something along the lines of, pick me up, I will rule you. And that is the last thing that a teenager that's developing independent wants, is for something else or someone else to control them.
Meanwhile, the Food and Drug Administration's plan is not to issue any new regulations on vaping until 2020. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
You're listening to 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
What does it take to hear someone out or even to change their mind?
The way in which we change people's minds is gradual and largely a function of continued exposure to alternative points of view. I don't think you can change people's conversations like the flick of a switch.
Ideas about why sometimes it's hard to agree to disagree. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT. News and ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Mid-Atlantic Eye Credit Union, a not-for-profit, member-owned financial cooperative, now helping members and their families protect their personally identifiable information with every secure checking account. More information at midalineicu.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the rate of teen deaths has a racial gap. An IPR report comes your way. Heartland Alliance released its 2018 Illinois poverty data, and McLean County has been placed on a watch list for well-being. GLT's Mary Cullen spoke with Heartland Alliance's Director of Research, Katie Butrago, about local poverty rates.
Butrago says poverty is not experienced the same for everyone across the state, and that McLean County is ranked 8th in the state for highest in child poverty.
Women, children, and people of color have higher poverty rates and are really feeling this impact more.
What do McLean County's poverty rates look like in the 2018 report? I know we're seeing a 20.6% poverty rate compared to the state's 13%.
McLean County is struggling with very high poverty rates. 1 in 5 people in McLean County live in poverty, which is higher than the Illinois rate of 13%. McLean County's poverty rate has also gone up almost 4 percentage points from the previous year, so poverty is getting worse over time. Child poverty is even higher in McLean County. Nearly 30% of children live in poverty. And this means that there's significant barriers to well-being in McLean County.
We're also seeing that McLean County is the 13th lowest unemployment rate in the state. So how does such a low rate of unemployment still put the county on a watch regarding poverty?
That's a good question. Employment is a really important part of poverty because it has to do with whether you're earning income or not, but it is only a small piece of the puzzle. Unemployment rate only takes into consideration whether someone has a job or not. It doesn't look at the quality of that job. Someone could be employed but not working enough hours to make ends meet, or their income could be very low and it doesn't put them above the poverty line. Unemployment rate doesn't take into account people who are out of the labor force, such as people with disabilities, people caring for family, or retired people, and they may have incomes below the poverty line.
McLean County is under a watch for poverty. Can you explain that scale? I know McLean has a well-being score of 5 out of 8 points. What does that mean?
So looking at poverty alone just shows one facet of people's well-being. It only looks at your income, but it doesn't take into account a lot of other factors of well-being, like cost of living or other indicators. So we created this well-being index to paint a more comprehensive picture than the income poverty rate can show alone. And we picked 4 key indicators that are predictive of future outcomes of well-being: high school graduation rate, teen birth rate, poverty rate, and unemployment rate. And counties get a negative point if they're doing worse than the state average or if their rate is getting worse over time. And in McLean County, it got on the watch list because it has a higher teen birth rate than the state average, a growing teen birth rate, a growing unemployment rate, a higher poverty rate than the state average, and a growing poverty rate.
The high teen birth rate, can you explain what that is?
So that looks at the number of births for teenagers in the county out of every 1,000 teens.
How do McLean's similar neighboring counties compare?
Both Peoria and Champaign County are on the watch list but have fewer points than McLean County does. And Sangamon County is on the watch list and has the same number of points as McLean County. Peoria has a lower high school graduation rate than the state average, a growing teen birth rate, a higher unemployment rate in the state, and a higher poverty rate in the state. Champaign has a lower high school graduation rate in the state, higher teen birth rate. Its teen birth rate has grown, and it has a higher poverty rate than Illinois. And Sangamon has a lower high school graduation rate than Illinois does. Its high school graduation rate is getting lower over time. Its teen birth rate is getting higher. Its unemployment rate is getting higher, and it has a higher poverty rate than Illinois.
So according to the 2018 Illinois Poverty Report, McLean has over 20,000 people living in poverty, and that's up 534 people from the previous year. What exactly does that mean, and what does it mean to be living in poverty?
Calculating poverty estimates involves adding up a family's income and figuring out if that amount falls below the poverty threshold for that family size. If it does below the threshold, then everyone in that family is considered to be in poverty. And these poverty thresholds are the same everywhere, and they're updated every year for inflation. But this measure is very outdated, and it's widely agreed to understate the degree of actual need. The federal poverty line was established in the 60s using food costs as its basis. And since then, it's just updated every year for inflation. It doesn't take into account other really important costs, such as health care or housing or child care. And most experts agree that it takes an income of around 2 to 3 times the poverty line to pay for most families' basic expenses.
For an example, what is the poverty line for, say, a family of four?
The poverty rate for a family of four is almost $25,000 per year.
McLean County's mean income deficit is nearly $10,000. Can you explain what this is and how that impacts the poverty rate?
Looking at the poverty rate alone doesn't quite paint a picture about the extent of deprivation in an area. It just tells you whether a family's income is above or below the poverty line. And the income deficit looks at the whole population of people in poverty, calculates the average income, and sees how far it falls below the poverty line. In McLean County, that gap between the poverty line and the average income of people who live in poverty is almost $10,000. And that means that people in poverty in McLean County are facing significant material deprivation.
What exactly can be done to lessen the poverty rate?
There's a lot that you can do at the county and local level to address the poverty rate. One thing is focus on creating an atmosphere of opportunity for working to attract and retain good-paying, stable jobs, jobs that can help people sustain a family above the poverty line. You can remove barriers to employment by focusing on expanding transportation and job training, removing barriers to receiving vital services like health care, mental health care, and food. We need to support and create opportunities for children through quality education, promote financial stability through encouraging banks to better serve low-income communities, and, you know, push the state and federal government to create and maintain strong anti-poverty programs.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. That was Mary Cullen speaking with Heartland Alliance Director of Research, Katie Butrago. Coming up, Ronald Reagan's boyhood home has needed help, a report from IPR. Mostly driven by homicides in Illinois, there is a gaping divide between teen death rates for blacks and other races. The gap is one of the largest in the nation. For this week's Illinois Issues Report, IPR's Maureen McKinney explores the problem.
Blair Holt was riding in a Chicago bus when he was shot and killed 11 years ago. His mother, Annette Nance Holt, a deputy district fire chief in Chicago, says she still regrets that she had plans that day which prevented her from giving 16-year-old Blair a ride. The honor student had to get from his Southside High School to his grandparents' store in the Roseland neighborhood.
Had I not had plans, Blair would probably be alive today. That's something I carry with me. And people go, you can't say that, but I do. Because as a mom, you know, my job is to protect my son.
The need to be so cautious wouldn't have existed had Blair not had to travel through troubled, predominantly African-American neighborhoods. There is a wide gap in the rate African-American children die in Illinois as opposed to other races. In fact, the black-white gap in Illinois for 2015 among teens was nearly the largest in the country. That's according to numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that were analyzed by Voices for Illinois Children. The Illinois child death rate has decreased for white and Hispanic children since 2005, while the black rate among teens is increasing.
So it really is an issue, I think, in Illinois that we have such large disparities. Our black teens, and especially our black males, are dying via gun homicide at rates that are more than 6 times the suicide rate for white teen boys, which is the leading cause of death for that group.
That's Anna Rowan of Voices for Illinois Children. She says the racial gap in teen deaths is the fourth largest in the country. There are organizations working to change the situation. Rebecca Levin is executive director of the organization Strengthening Chicago's Youth, which is based at the Anne and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. Her group is a violence prevention collaborative.
Now, when this kind of disparity exists, we have to look at why that happens. It's not just accidental that this happens. It's also not the fault of black boys.
Annette Nance Holt, Blair Holt's mother agrees.
A lot of people tend to think, number one, most of the young people who are being murdered are in a gang, they're not good kids, they're out here doing the wrong things, and it's not true. These are average young people trying to do things everybody did. And there is a great disparity in what African-American community looks like in certain neighborhoods as opposed to other communities.
Rebecca Levin says there are policies in place that affect health equity for communities with concentrated disadvantages, often neighborhoods of color. She cites policies that allow what she calls structural racism to occur. That includes mass incarceration of blacks as a result of the war on drugs. Policies that would improve the situation, she says, would be investment in black communities, improved mental health services, and greater gun violence prevention methods. She says, while Illinois has relatively strong gun laws, neighboring states such as Wisconsin and Indiana do not. The state legislature earlier this year created a children's health caucus that will deal with issues related to inequity in child death rates, according to Senate Chairwoman of the caucus, Julie Morrison, a Deerfield Democrat.
We don't have health equity across the state. The racial divide also kind of conforms to some of the socioeconomic disparities we have.
But Annette Nance Holt wants to also see something done about racial disparity.
These people, they need to wake up. Right now, it's our community. It's going to keep spreading and spreading and spreading. It's like a virus. It really is.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a report on a change in collecting patterns for political memorabilia. A couple of years ago, Ronald Reagan's first boyhood home in Dixon was, as the Washington Post put it, falling apart. Today, things are looking much better, but the museum says there's still more to be done. IPR's Guy Stevens has more.
Volunteer Cheryl Yard gives me a tour of the two-story 19th century frame house on Hennepin Avenue that the Reagans lived in from 1920 to 1923. A foundation was set up to restore and manage the house soon after Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980. Yard says they went to great lengths to make it as close as possible to how it was when Jack Reagan, his wife Nell, and their boys Neil and Ronald lived there. She points to the wallpaper. Like in a lot of old houses, there were many layers.
They took the paper off, sent it to President Reagan and his brother, and said, which layer did you have? And they replicated that. I think it's pretty impressive myself.
The furnishings had been lost in a fire, and the big cast iron tub in the small upstairs bathroom was the only original piece that remained. But again, with the help of the Reagan brothers, the home was recreated with period furnishings that match what was there at the time. Yard says there's one feature in the sitting room that everyone, especially kids, enjoy hearing about, a loose tile in front of the fireplace that Reagan insisted be kept that way during the restoration. The reason why was revealed when the president and his brother Neil came to the dedication in 1984.
He found the tile and he says, Neil, give me some pennies. So Neil gives him some pennies and he puts them down there. He says, what are you doing? He says, this is where I used to hide my money from you.
The original tile is now in the Reagan Library and Museum in California, but a copy keeps the story alive in Dixon. Reagan Home Executive Director Patrick Gorman says a steady stream of visitors have come since its opening, last year from every state and 27 countries. But, Gorman says, over the decades the money dwindled and supporters moved or passed away. Time took its inevitable toll on the home, the old house next door that serves as a visitor center, and the rest of the small campus. So when Washington Post writer Roxanne Roberts wrote an article in October 2016 that began, Ronald Reagan's house is falling apart, she wasn't far off the mark. Gorman says he was shocked at the museum's state of disrepair when he took the director's job that year and set out to change that.
We put a roof on the visitor center, we sited it, new storm windows, we painted the home, got new storm windows for the home, tuck point of the basement, you name it, and we've done it.
There was no money for all the work, Gorman says, but repairs couldn't wait.
We went to the local bank and we took out a line of credit. That's what we had to do. And we are in the process of paying it back. Board of directors is working on fundraising at this time, and I have all the confidence in the world in my new board.
Even the grass is new, looking lush and well cared for thanks to a dedicated volunteer. The visitors' bathrooms have been remodeled, and repairs continue on window frames and other parts of the old structures. But there's always more to be done. A lifelong resident of Dixon, Gorman says this job is part of his commitment to helping his hometown. But there's also a personal connection.
My parents owned the second Ronald Reagan home in Dixon. So I grew up, you know, hearing about Ronald Reagan long before he was president, the actor. And it was kind of a big deal in my parents' eyes that, you know, they owned the second home.
And though most visitors won't know it, there's evidence of that connection in the Reagan home. Sitting on the fireplace mantle, an old photograph of the future president that Gorman found in the museum's collection.
That's my mom and dad's house. That's in the front yard. That's special to me.
It doesn't really belong here, he says, but he thinks 2 years of 50-hour weeks spent restoring the site ought to entitle him to something. And it is a picture of Reagan as a boy in Dixon, after all. Perks, personal connections, and civic pride aside, Gorman says it's important to keep a place like this up. That's what people expect and should expect to see.
If I went to a presidential home, Grant's, for example, or Herbert Hoover, and I've been to both of them, they look very dignified and very professional, and that's what I was striving to achieve here, and I think we're nearly there. We're nearly there.
After all, he says, it's not about politics, it's about history, and a place that the only U.S. president born in Illinois called home. I'm Guy Stevens.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Collectors of political buttons, posters, and other memorabilia recently gathered in Springfield. The city hosted the National Convention of the American Political Item Collectors. Most items commemorate presidential battles like Lincoln, Douglas, Kennedy, Nixon, even Trump, Clinton. But during what many are calling the political year of the woman, exhibitors say they are seeing growing interest for collectibles from women's rights movement. Illinois Newsroom's Mary Hansen reports.
Collectors of political buttons, posters, and other memorabilia gathered in Springfield recently. It was the National American Political Items Collectors Convention. Most items commemorate presidential battles like Lincoln versus Douglas, Kennedy versus Nixon, even Trump versus Clinton. But as Illinois Newsroom's Mary Hansen reports, in the year of the woman, some exhibitors are seeing growing interest in items from the women's suffrage movement.
So once again, if you're the winning bidder, you pick up your item, the blue sheet.
Just before noon on a recent Saturday, a group of political memorabilia collectors jostle for a spot around an exhibit table, checking their final bids in a silent auction.
All right, 1 minute, everybody. 1 minute.
While most of the auction items feature presidential candidates, Kate Palchewski is in a bidding battle over three small buttons from the early 1900s that say votes for women.
The bids were just going up by like $3 or $4 at each bid, and then I just bumped it by about 15 or 16.
Two buttons are from the campaign to give women the right to vote in Pennsylvania. The third is from the National Women's Party.
3, 2, 1. Okay, pencils, pens down. Pick up your items.
She won the pins for just over $100. Palchewski teaches communications at the University of Northern Iowa. She plans to use the buttons in her research and in the classroom.
There's something material and real, and almost the sense that you're touching the people who did the activism back in time.
Nearly 100 years after women won the right to vote, competition for postcards, sashes, and other items from the suffrage movement is growing fiercer in a collectible market still largely dominated by men.
Yes, it's an old man, white old man group. And that's a shame.
Janine Kalp is one of a handful of women in the group. Kalp is a former history teacher from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. She collects homefront items, banners, posters, and household items that show support for the armed forces, as well as stuff from the women's suffrage movement and Teddy Roosevelt's campaigns. What attracts her is
the beauty of it. Graphically and color, they are awesome.
She thinks interest in the pins and sashes from the early 20th century fight for women's right to vote started growing about a decade ago.
At one time, suffrage and civil rights was lower priced, and many people got into it then.
It was less about the meaning of the items and more about the thrill of the hunt. People who wanted to get into the hobby could start small, at maybe $1 a button, and build up a collection that way.
One of the problems is it's too darn expensive these days.
Ken Florey has also noticed the trend. He's one of the more well-known women's suffrage collectors and sellers. He says there's a downside to increased popularity. The rising prices edge casual collectors out of the market.
I would love to have a bunch of cheap suffrage items that I could sell to people. You know, they just would like to have a memento or two. You know, they're not serious collectors, but it is a very meaningful thing for them.
Flory says one way to share the hobby is to have scholars collect memorabilia and publish it in books, scholars like Palchevsky, who won the buttons in the auction earlier. She's writing a book on the final 10 years of the suffrage movement. She says some of the same arguments for and against allowing women to vote come up in political discussion today.
Think about the arguments that were used against Hillary Clinton, that women are too physically weak to assume the presidency. And there were tons of arguments that women were too weak to deserve the right to vote.
Palchevsky says voting rights must be guarded and fought for, and that studying suffrage movements, particularly the stuff from those movements, reminds us of the stakes.
The postcards, the flyers, the handbills, the pinback buttons, the toothpick holders, the banners, they make history seem real in a way that digital images or books that tell stories about what happened may not.
I'm Mary Hansen, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a collaboration focused on expanding coverage of education, state politics, health, and the environment. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, and Colleen Reynolds. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.